Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnen? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
You're listening to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tan, and plenty coming up on this edition. We're going to talk about Apple and AI, and also about one of my favourite bands, Queen, who are about to sell their back catalogue for a huge amount of money, more than $1 billion. We'll be finding out why it's worth so much. But firstly, the Hindujas are Britain's wealthiest family, with a net worth estimated at around $47 billion. That's a lot of money. They have homes around the world, and a court in Switzerland has today handed down jail sentences to four members of the family for exploiting servants imported from their native India to work in their villa in Geneva. They were accused of spending more on their pets than on the servants they bought from India. But their lawyer said he was shocked at the verdict.
J'ai le sentiment que
I have the feeling that the behaviour was judged on moral grounds and not on legal grounds. On the one hand, you have a very wealthy family, and on the other, poor people. Objectively, therefore, it's a kind of punishment for this gap between the two groups of people. I would remind you that these people were very well treated, respected, and never humiliated. That's why I'm so shocked by this ruling.
Let's get more details of what actually has been taking place. Imogen Fuchs is the BBC's Geneva correspondent. I asked her what kind of details about the treatment of the servants were heard in court.
You know, the evidence that came out was really quite disturbing and sad. I mean, what you heard was that the people who were recruited from India were from very poor backgrounds. Some of them were illiterate. They were paid a fraction of what the minimum wage would be in Geneva. They were paid in rupees, apparently, into bank accounts in India, which they couldn't access. Their passports had been confiscated, rarely allowed to leave the house. One of the complainants testified that she worked for them for years and basically slept down in the cellar. So when you consider the part of Geneva that this very, very wealthy family lived in a very wealthy part, like I said, a villa on the shores of Lake Geneva, it really is quite disturbing that something like that was going on in 2024. And I think that perhaps that's the thinking of the judge who told them, you know, you have abused your wealth and power to exploit some very poor and vulnerable people.
It is that contrast, isn't it, that I think will shock many people. For our listeners, can you just tell them a little bit about the Hinduja family? They're an extremely wealthy family, aren't they, that originate from India?
Well, that's right. But they're also called Britain's wealthiest family because they are also British. Now, they have a rumoured fortune of more than $30 billion. They have made their money in things like oil and gas investments. They have interests in healthcare. They employ around 200,000 people around the world. So this is a vast enterprise. Now, it's a pretty big family. This wing of the family has lived in Geneva for quite some time. And Prakash, the father in this particular case, it was the father, his wife, the son and his wife who were in the dock. He, I believe, now also has Swiss citizenship. And today, the Swiss court said that's not how you treat your servants. You're very wealthy. You do not employ people on that kind of basis. And they are facing custodial sentences.
They are. Are they likely to appeal against those custodial sentences?
Literally in the last few minutes, we have heard their lawyer said they plan to appeal. None of the four were in court today. And we were a bit surprised at that because the younger two, AJ and his wife Namrata, had been in court earlier this week. But I don't know, perhaps sensing things were not going their way, none of the four were in court. People were then questioning, you know, have they fled? It looks as if they're around. They will appeal. But the judge has said a custodial sentence of between 4 and 4.5 years. And they have to pay damages running into the hundreds of thousands of Swiss francs, or hundreds of thousands of pounds or dollars. So, you know, watch this space. But at the moment, this is a really surprise. We didn't expect custodial sentences. But given the evidence, the judge obviously felt that that was merited.
Imogen, I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on that for the BBC. In terms of Geneva itself, this is one of the wealthiest parts of the world. Has there been shock about this case? Have people been surprised that these sort of things were going on in one of the wealthiest parts of the world?
One of the reactions to this case has been a little bit, oh, not again, because frankly, there have been other cases of very wealthy people abusing the people who work for them, whether it is in villas owned by business people, whether even in some of the diplomatic missions to the United Nations. There was a case last year where people working in a diplomatic mission took their employers to court saying they hadn't been paid for years, or whether in the 5-star hotels along the lakes of the shores of Lake Geneva, which are very, very popular with the very, very wealthy, particularly in the summer months. They come, and there have been cases. I'll give you one example, although it was eventually dropped amid a diplomatic spat, that the son of the former and late Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, his son was arrested with his wife in a Geneva hotel, accused of exploiting and beating their servants. Now, there's a huge row between Switzerland and Libya about that, and the case was eventually dropped. But frankly, the fact that abuse of servants by very, very wealthy people in Geneva happens has been known for quite some time.
Imogen Fuchs then will be taking a closer look at that story in our Business Matters programme at midnight GMT. Let us move over and talk about a company that we often focus on this programme. Apple says it's going to delay launching 3 new artificial intelligence features in Europe because the company says European Union competition rules require it to ensure that rival products and services can function with its devices. Let's bring in Chris Lowe, Chief Economist with FHN Financial. Chris, AI really seems to be driving up stock prices in the US. How much of a setback is this for Apple, do you think?
Well, it is a setback, obviously, because this was their entree into the AI space. But at the same time, it's also a setback for Apple customers who will be missing out on these features that they might be able to get on other products. But it's also understandable from Apple's standpoint, the DMA requirement that it share access makes customer information vulnerable. They can't necessarily protect it. And until they can figure out how they can do that, they're just going to keep it, I guess, under wraps.
It's interesting, isn't it? Is this going to be a problem for tech companies, do you think, that at the moment there is a clear difference in the laws of, let's say, the EU, which is stricter, and the US?
Well, it is. You know, they've learned a little bit of how to deal with this because, of course, China also has very different laws for tech companies. And so that they are learning to put things behind firewalls. But the internet tends to function better if it's open. But obviously, at the same time, the EU is doing its best to make sure that its citizens have the best products and fair competition.
Yeah, interesting to see how this is going to pan out, whether the US actually tightens up its rules as well. Let's hop over from the US border and go to Canada, where for the past few days there have been lots of headlines like this.
In New Brunswick, schools closed early because of sweltering temperatures. It was 35 degrees Celsius in some places, and with the Humidex, that feels more like 45. New Brunswick remains under a severe heat warning. It's the same in much.
We have this week talking about the heat, haven't we, in many different parts of the world here on the BBC World Service. So we wanted to hear from someone who spent a lot of time working outside. So let's bring in Hannah Kaye, an organizer with Canada's National Farmers Union, herself a farm worker in Quebec. Hannah, thanks so much for joining us here on World Business Report.
Thanks for having me.
How difficult has the past week been for you and other farmers? Just describe what it's like working outside, working in greenhouses in those temperatures.
It's been a real challenge. So climate change is definitely creating increasingly difficult and dangerous working conditions. This week, we started at 6 a.m. on the farm instead of our usual 7 so that we could try to beat most of the heat. We were taking breaks. We were encouraging each other to go into the cold room. But, you know, there's only so much you can do. And if a tomato is ripe in the greenhouse, it doesn't care if you're boiling. It needs to get harvested.
Do you find that in those conditions, your own productivity begins to drop because it is so hard to work in the heat?
Absolutely, absolutely. Not only are we all fighting the exhaustion that comes with working in the heat, we're also risking the dangers associated with extreme heat. So there are people who have to take days off of work because they've exposed themselves too long to high temperatures. And although I work on a really lovely farm, I'm quite lucky. I'm Canadian born. I work on a beautiful organic farm here in Western Quebec. We at the National Farmers Union feel that it shouldn't really matter who your employer is and how nice your employer is, that workplace safety needs to go beyond just on-farm policy. And become something that we regulate and we take very seriously in the provinces across Canada.
How do you do that, though? Because you're in a profession where you have to work outside, don't you, really? So there's not much protection you can get from the sun when you're out in those fields. What sort of things can be brought into place? Because the problem that we're talking about today is going to become a bigger problem in the years to come, isn't it?
Yeah, so farm workers and producers are absolutely more vulnerable to the dangers of working in extreme heat. There are statistics coming from the United States that farm workers are 35 times more likely to die of workplace to have a workplace fatality because of extreme heat than workers in other sectors. But at the same time, we're calling for a baseline standard of clear and enforceable health and safety regulations that we feel would actually safeguard workers against the worst impacts of the climate crisis.
Give me some examples of them.
Yeah, so we're talking about shade infrastructure, cool and potable water. We're talking about rest and work cycling, sick days. Many workers feel that they have to keep showing up to work and pushing themselves to the extreme. They feel that they can't take breaks. In many provinces across Canada, farm workers are actually denied protections that we think should be universal. They're denied minimum wage protections. They're denied rest periods mandatory rest periods between their work hours, rest periods during their work hours. And all of this, when you're talking about extreme heat, these become health and safety concerns. So we're really calling for labor protections, fundamental labor protections for workers. We're talking about the right to unionize so that workers have a voice in their workplaces. We're talking about the right to permanent residency status so that the migrant workers who come to work in the fields and do the essential work of producing food and profit for Canada feel that they actually can refuse unsafe work without the risk of deportation.
There's a lot of different issues there, aren't there? Some of them directly related to the heat, some of them, some would say maybe not. Finally, you've only got 30 seconds. How does the heat affect the crops?
So So when it's too hot to harvest a crop, we're talking about crop loss. So we often talk about crop loss in terms of the actual effect of the heat on the plants themselves, but we're really trying to bring attention to the human impact of the heat on the crops.
Hannah, been delightful having you on the program. Good luck out there in the heat on the farm that you work on in Quebec. Let's bring Chris back in here. Canada has that heat dome problem, doesn't it? Lots of the US as well. And it is always a human impact. We hear that there, the possibility of people losing their lives. But the economic impact is big as well, isn't it, Chris?
It is. It tends to cause people, even those who don't have to work outdoors, and especially those who don't, will stay in. There's less spending on services, less shopping going on, less travel for work. We've got more people working from home. And it's a terrible strain on the electrical infrastructure.
It is indeed. Remind us of where you are, Chris. And we're asking it of most guests nowadays. Give us a bit of a weather report of how your week is going.
Yeah. No, I'm in New York, in New York City, where it's 90 Fahrenheit now, which is about 32. I was in Chicago yesterday, where it was 100 just outside the city, which goes to about 38 centigrade. So very hot there. Thankfully, though, it is still fairly early in the year, and it is cooling down at night. When we get this kind of heat later in the summer, particularly in the big cities, it just does not cool down.
At all. Well, that is happening in many parts of the world. We've heard a lot from India, haven't we, over the course of the last few days, and from the Hajj as well. You're with World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. Imagine you're a business owner who comes up with a great product. You'd be really happy, wouldn't you? After all that designing and manufacturing and testing, you take the steps to make sure that you're the only one who can sell it. You file trademarks, copyrights and patents. You're all set, right? Not exactly. With the rise of third-party sellers on e-commerce sites like Amazon and Temu, knockoffs are a growing problem for many, many businesses. $2 trillion worth of counterfeit products are sold each year. And as marketplaces, Christine Schwab reports, taking copycats off the market requires a lot of time and also money.
Deborah Holtzschlag isn't really a plant lady, but she is married to a plant man.
He does not golf. He gardens.
Which was a delight until the dahlias took over their patio. So Holtzschlag designed a solution, a planter that attaches to railing balusters with a tension clip. It makes the plants look kind of like they're floating. And that's the feature that made her company, Plant Traps, go viral. But soon enough,
I saw a knockoff using all of my language, you know, printed all my directions in their box, used my trademark in their metadata.
Holtzschlag sent me some of these listings, and they're such obvious ripoffs. Like, some sellers steal photos of her holding her planter full of red mums and just crop out her head. And seeing this, her hard work copied again and again, sent Holtzschlag into overdrive, filing reports to Amazon, Temu, and eBay. This involves uploading her legal documents and screenshots of listings. Each complaint takes about 30 minutes.
It became a full-time job, to be honest. At first, I was doing all the reporting myself, 4 hours a day.
Temu, eBay, and Amazon, a marketplace underwriter, sent statements saying counterfeit goods are prohibited on their platforms and that they have measures to both prevent the sale of these items and respond to complaints. And Holtzschlag says retailers do usually take action within a few days. But new listings kept popping up, so she hired lawyers. This April alone, they found more than 500 knockoffs selling for as little as 99 cents a planter. The real ones cost $19.99. Hilton Hart is the CEO of Edison IP Enforcement, a law firm that goes after counterfeiters. He says e-commerce platforms, especially ones that feature third-party sellers, have turned tackling fakes into a global game of whack-a-mole.
Every country's legal system is different, and you have to take individual actions in each of the different countries. And so it just becomes a logistical nightmare.
Hart says the majority of counterfeits come from China, where manufacturing is lightning fast and can be super secretive. He's actually sent investigators there for cases that require serving paperwork in person.
And the address said floor 5, but there were only 3 floors in the building. Or the investigator would show up to an empty field and there's just no office building in sight.
This shady business is tough for companies, but it's also a problem for consumers. Anonymous sellers abroad might not have high-quality standards. Carrie Camel, who directs the Center for Anti-Counterfeiting and Product Protection at Michigan State, says some products can even be dangerous.
And it's sort of a game of roulette. We're talking potentially very high risk, right, for injury, for, in some cases, death, depending on what it is.
Think counterfeit vitamins or car seats. And Camel says even seemingly innocent items like clothing can contain ingredients like lead. Recently proposed legislation would require companies to vet sellers before listing. In the meantime, it's on consumers. Camel encourages shoppers to buy directly from brands and reputable retailers. She's well aware, though, that people purposely scour the internet for fake Gucci belts and Apple headphone lookalikes. She says, think twice about where knockoffs come from. They can have seedy connections.
A lot of counterfeiting, not all, but a lot of it is connected to organized crime. It's connected to illicit drug networks. It might be going to support child labor. Like, there's a reason why this product is so cheap.
Suddenly, a good deal might not feel so good.
Kristen Schwab there with that report, Chris, and that is a growing problem, isn't it, for companies, big ones and some small ones as well?
Well, it's rampant, and it's a big problem partly because when you look at goods sales, for example, in the United States, more than 20% of retail sales now are online, and so it's difficult, for example, to see a product before you buy it. Very often, you don't know you're buying a counterfeit.
No, that is very, very true. Just want to bring you in on something else that we were discussing on the program yesterday, was this US decision to ban the sale of antivirus software Kaspersky. Now they've actually gone further and slapped sanctions on 12 people in senior leadership roles at the company. When you're talking to investors now, national security becoming such a big economic issue, is that things investors are looking at with some companies and worrying, oh, could that company get involved in some sort of national security concern?
It's huge. And, you know, it's particularly prevalent with Chinese companies where the focus has been on national security issues with things like chip technology, for example. But this is a new front. We haven't seen this kind of crackdown on Russian tech before.
Yeah, we haven't, have we? Stay with us, Chris. Want to get your thoughts on this, because news has been coming in that one of the most valuable back catalogues in the music world has reportedly been sold. I'm talking about this band. Queen, of course. Now, the music magazine Variety is reporting that a deal worth $1.3 billion is in the bag for the band with Sony. I spoke to the journalist at Variety who's behind that report. It's executive editor for Music, Jem Aswad.
A lot of this is coming from inside sources. As I understand it, this deal has been in the works for several months. The catalog's been on the market for several years, and it is finally getting toward a closing stage with Sony for a reported £1 billion, which is $1.27 billion, I think, which would make it the biggest deal of its kind that we know of anyway, because a lot of these deals happen and they're just not announced anywhere.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because with Sony, and you sort of alluded to it there, they've done other big deals, haven't they, with the likes of Springsteen and Dylan, but they don't announce them.
Yeah, and they are under no obligation to announce them. A lot of the time, the lawyers will want to make a big deal out of it, or, you know, the management, or even the artists will just say, hey, look what I got. Aren't I important? But a lot of them aren't bothered by that. You know, both Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen did nine-figure deals with Sony Music for, in Dylan's case, it was for his recorded music. And in Springsteen's case, it was for his recorded music rights and his publishing rights. I think that was in the $600 million range. But it didn't even come out for months because it wasn't officially announced anywhere. These things sometimes turn up in tax statements and things like that, which is how we nosy journalists find out. Or sometimes a source will just tell us.
Did that number surprise you when Springsteen got $500 million? Is this about Queen, or is it just that music rights are getting more and more valuable by the year?
I think in this case, it's what they were willing to sell, because they sold everything except performance revenues, because Brian May and Roger Taylor still tour as Queen, so they weren't going to sell that off. But there are things like name and likeness, which Springsteen didn't sell. Okay. But with Queen, the legend of Freddie Mercury and the biopic Bohemian Rhapsody, all those things add up to enormous possibilities for musicals or, you know, jukebox musicals or anything like they could think of to do with Queen's name and likeness, which are extremely iconic. They've got that amazing logo that Freddie Mercury designed himself. And, you know, when you're selling likeness, you're basically selling the rights to your face. So there's an awful lot that they can do there. And the members of Queen, although they were a fractious group creatively, they've pretty much always been on the same side when it comes to business and very savvy about it. And they were clearly pretty much in lockstep on this.
In terms of who's going to overtake them, because we love that sort of questions, don't we? Queen at the moment, probably, well, definitely, aren't they? If they get that figure, will be the most that anybody's ever received. Can you see anybody going past that in the next few months, next few years?
The Beatles are the absolute very top asset in this class right there. So are the Rolling Stones, but I can't see them ever selling. Really, all you have to do is think about who the biggest artists of the last 50 years are, and there's the answer.
Gemma Aswad there with that particular report. They're looking at the amount of money that Queen seem to be getting for their back catalogue. Chris, that is a pretty staggering amount of money, isn't it? And showing that the value of music is increasing all the time from the last sort of big sale of the Springsteen stuff.
That's right. No, I think it's absolutely brilliant too, though. David Bowie was the first who really cashed in. And why not? You know, they're getting older. They should enjoy the money while they can, the wealth while they can. And at the same time, with Queen, it's not like they're writing new songs. They exist now to perform as a band, and they still have the right to do that. But in the meantime, Sony can, well, I suppose, find ways to cash in on the catalog they've just bought.
Yeah. Chris, as always, thank you very much for joining us here on World Business Report. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, helping us, guide us through some of those economic stories that we have been covering. Of course, we have to add here, when it comes to the Queen rights, that excludes the US and Canada, because those rights are held by Disney at the moment. So if they could have bought those rights as well, if Sony do go ahead with it, could have been a lot more than $1.3 billion. That's it for World Business Report.